welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. Y'all have heard me talk about wanting to have a ghostwriter on the show for quite a while now, and I am thrilled to have finally found the perfect guest. Barbara Feinman-Todd is the author of her 2017 memoir, Pretend I'm Not Here, How I Worked with Three Newspaper Icons, One Powerful First Lady, and Still Managed to Dig Myself Out of the Washington Swamp, where she talks about her experience researching and ghostwriting for some extremely heavy political hitters. Former First Lady Hillary Clinton's It Takes a Village, Bob Woodward's Veil, Carl Bernstein's Loyalties, and former Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley's A Good Life, among others. You sort of hit the trio of Watergate in there.
I did.
Barbara taught journalism at Georgetown University for 25 years and was the founding director of Georgetown's journalism programs. She is now professor emerita at Georgetown University. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm thrilled to talk to you. And as I was listening to your memoir, I kept a list of questions, and that list went very, very long. So I'm so excited to hear more about ghostwriting. I feel like this is a field in publishing that the general public doesn't know a lot about. So we have a lot of curious listeners.
Great. I'm excited to tell them everything, almost.
I mean, you've already told a lot in your memoir.
No, I did. Believe it or not, there were a few things I didn't put in there, but you can't tell everything.
Of course not. Of course not. So we're going to start with sort of nuts and bolts about ghostwriting, and then we're going to move into some more of the emotional side of ghostwriting.
Okay, great.
So how did you get into ghostwriting in particular?
I got into ghostwriting the way a lot of writers do, totally by accident. You know, it's not something that you aspire to. You know, when you're a little kid, you don't say, Mommy, Daddy, when I grow up, I want to be a ghostwriter. I was in my 20s and I was working at the Washington Post, and I wrote a manuscript, a draft of a novel, and I ended up getting an amazing agent, a New York agent named Flip Brophy, and she tried to sell my novel. And she couldn't. So dejected, I just crawled back into my hole and kept working at the Washington Post. And then she called me up and she said, well, I'm sorry I couldn't sell the novel, but I have an idea. How would you like to be a ghostwriter? I know of a client. It actually wasn't her client. Another agent had contacted her. There was a congresswoman, Marjorie Margolis Mizvinsky, a congresswoman from Philadelphia, who had gotten a book contract to write about the year of the woman in the 90s. More women than ever had been elected to Congress, and she needed a ghostwriter. And so Flip, my agent, said, how would you like to do it? I'll put your hat in the ring. So I said, sure. I didn't even, you know, I vaguely knew what a ghostwriter did, but I didn't know any ghostwriters. So I ended up getting hired for that. And I used my reporting skills. So I had been working at the Washington Post then for several years. And at that point, I had gone freelance and was just a book researcher. And I used my reporting skills and I went around and I interviewed all the women in Congress and then some of the men. And I think in 6 months, I did all the reporting and all the writing of the book.
That's fast.
It was really fast.
Is that typical?
So I noticed in when you sent me the email describing what you wanted to talk about, you had several questions about, you know, is X typical? Is
right.
Y typical? And I thought, I want to tell Sarah that with ghostwriting, there isn't really a typical.
Oh, interesting.
You know, every book has its own life, and especially with ghostwriting, because you've got more cooks in the kitchen. So I would say that 6 months is not unusual, but it's definitely on the faster side. And it's not something that I would agree to
up front
if I were still ghostwriting. Yeah. But they're often trying to catch a wave. the publisher. And this wave was, you know, women rising in politics. So I didn't know any better. So I said yes. And then I didn't know any better. So I set out to do it. And I did. It was exhausting.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
And how is it determined that a particular subject will need a ghostwriter? And is that sort of up for debate ever?
There's different reasons why people need ghostwriters. Sometimes people are actually perfectly capable of writing their own book, but they're a very important person for one reason or another. That's why they got a book contract and they don't have time.
Sure.
And then many people are famous for doing or being something else and they don't have professional writing skills. And, you know, sometimes it's a combination of both. It's mostly time and skill. Those are the two obvious ones. And then sometimes people, to answer the second part of the question, sometimes people think that they can write the book themselves.
Yes. I was about to ask you that.
And then the editor doesn't agree with them. And so the editor suggests they hire a ghostwriter. And that's how that happens. And sometimes what happens is if somebody's really insistent they want to do it themselves, the editor will talk them into more of like a writing coach or, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of services that a ghostwriter can offer, from just research to developmental editing to line editing, interviewing, you know, it just depends. That's why there's no typical answer.
Sure. And I know in your book, you already knew the subjects of the bigger books that you ghosted, but would you typically always meet personally with the subject before you agreed to take on the job?
Absolutely. And I think it would be very rare that somebody, why don't we call them the, in contracts, and I know that's something you want to talk about.
Yes.
In the legal document where you're setting this thing up, the famous person is called the author and the ghostwriter is called the writer.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Yes. So you would always meet with the subject because the subject or the author, in quotes,
sure,
would definitely want to vet you. I mean, it would be like hiring a therapist without meeting them first or having a phone call.
Right. And do you also want to vet them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the beginning, beggars can't be choosers. And, you know, I would take what I could get. But after I had done a few books, you know, I can remember like literally running away, going for one of these interviews and being bored out of my mind, talking to them for a half hour. And if that happened, that was a really good sign that it was going to be such an uphill battle to make this thing interesting. And did I want to share the same space with that person for 6 months or 8 months, meaning going over to their house or their office or following them around in their busy day or getting on a plane or a train with them, because that sometimes was the only free time they would have. So if I couldn't bear their company or the story, then I would turn it down unless it was a gajillion dollars.
And how much access do you normally have? And do you sort of have to almost give up your own life to shadow this person?
So again, there's no typical answer to that. But the allure of this job, besides the money, is the access, especially for somebody like me. And I would venture to say someone like you, who's very curious and loves asking questions.
Sure.
I've been a journalist my whole adult life, and there's always a struggle for access. Doors are always being slammed in your face, and phones are, you're being hung up on, and all that. But with ghostwriting, it's the opposite. If they want a decent book, they have to give you access. And so you've got a lot of access. You don't always have the freedom to use what you learn because they want their best selves put forward. It's kind of like going on Instagram and everybody's having a great time in St. Bart's and their families are never arguing and, you know, everything looks perfect. And that's how people often want their ghostwritten books to come off. And so there's always this struggle in a speech I give about how the book will be so much better if you're honest.
Right.
That's why it took me a long time to make the decision to write my own memoir, because I knew if I did it, I had to be really, really honest. And that's a very scary vulnerable thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And do, I'm going to use the word author now, but y'all remember, author doesn't actually mean the writer. The author means the subject of the book. Do the authors have veto power over sort of what you put in and what you leave out? And has there ever been a battle about whether to leave something in or take it out?
Oh, God. That is the biggest challenge. They have total veto power. That's in the contract.
Sure.
You know, it's their life. It's their story. They own it. You're like a hired assassin. You don't get to choose who you kill.
Right.
And that's really frustrating for somebody with a journalism background, because you're getting what you always dreamed of, which is the truth. You're getting at least glimpses of it, even if they don't share it, just the nature of you being in the room, being around them, being around the people in their lives. You glean things. And then you write it, and they don't want that. It is always the struggle. And the publishing house wants it, obviously, to be as honest as possible, because that sells more books.
Sure.
Makes a better book, it sells more books. And so you're literally in the middle of this tug of war of information and revelation.
I want to put a pin in this, because we're going to come back to this when we do our book recommendations, I think.
Okay.
We're going to talk about a specific example where sort of the truth versus sanitize, and then how do you feel about it later,
right,
comes out. But how do y'all generally get paid, and who pays you?
Generally, the author, the celebrity, pays you.
Like actually out of their own pocket?
Yes. Like you get a check or a wire transfer from their personal account. And depending on their finances and their comfort level and all that, how much they trust you. It's generally the schedule of payment follows the payment from the publishing house to the celebrity. And those are usually doled out in either 3 or 4 payments. There are times, like with Hillary Clinton, the publishing house paid me.
Yes.
And that was because she was a sitting first lady. She didn't keep the money. She gave it to charities, and they just wanted all to be nice and neat. And so the publishing house paid me, and they paid me in scheduled payments. And in fact, as you know, since you read my book, when the shit hit the fan with Hillary Clinton, which I guess we'll talk about.
Yes. And y'all, I will link to some articles summarizing what happened with Hillary Clinton as well in the show notes.
When the shit hit the fan, the publishing house tried to withhold my final payment of $30,000. I was paid $120,000, and they tried to withhold that. And so there was a big mess about that. They ultimately paid me.
And what was the mess called? Was it Village Gate or Ghostwriter Gate? What gate was it?
Yeah. So Maureen Dowd, the New York Times columnist, she wrote a column about it and called it Thank You Gate.
Thank You Gate. Okay. Yes. Because it involved more people than you, right? She didn't thank anybody.
She didn't thank anybody. She said there were too many people to thank. It was in my contract she was supposed to thank me, which is typical. And it might sound weird that that would be in a contract, but a ghostwriter's bread and butter is their track record and their, you know, it's your resume. And so if your name isn't going on the cover of a book, then you're acknowledged in the acknowledgments, and you can point to that. And it's sort of proof that you worked on the book. And if you don't have that, then it feels like you've been totally erased. So when she didn't thank anybody, that blew up in her face. And the irony of it was, by not thanking me, it turned into this huge flap, and it put me on the map for, you know, my 15 minutes of fame. And even though there was this big, nasty fight about her not thanking me, and then this other part of it came out, my phone didn't stop ringing from people wanting me to ghostwrite their book.
I'm sure.
And like, they didn't even care that I was involved in this terrible conflict, because it gets more complicated and I'm not completely innocent in what happened. All people cared about was that my name was associated with Hillary Clinton and I had worked on her book. So I was a status symbol. Oh, if she worked on Hillary Clinton's book, I want her to work on my book.
Sure.
That was in 1995, 1996. And I still, to this day, get queries over email, LinkedIn, Twitter, people wanting me to write their book because I worked on Hillary Clinton's book. That old phrase, just spell my name right. There's no, you know, there's no bad publicity.
Sure. Well, at least you got a silver lining out of it.
No, there was. It's a silver lining, but it didn't do much for my stomach lining.
No, I'm sure. Oh my, I cannot even imagine being on the other side of a kind of scandal with such a powerful person. That's got to be terrifying.
It was so terrifying.
We talked a little bit about how being acknowledged in the acknowledgement section, being thanked for your work, is generally in the contract. But you can also get your name on the cover of the book. How important is that, and what would enable that to happen for a ghostwriter?
Yeah. So that is something that the ghostwriter and her agent would negotiate for. For me, it wasn't that important because I just wanted to be acknowledged so that I would be assured that I could keep getting, you know, more gigs and, you know, that there is my imprint somewhere in the book that's explicit. But I didn't really care much about my name being on the cover of the book because as a ghostwriter, I wanted to do a great job and I wanted the book to do well, but it wasn't my story. And if I did my job really well, the voice of the author, the voice of the celebrity would feel authentic.
Sure.
And so in the end, it wasn't really my book. So I didn't feel like I needed my name on it. It's not like a book, you know, like my memoir that is mine and comes from my soul. This is more of a business transaction. And so in a practical sense, I wanted my name in the acknowledgement. I wanted to be thanked for helping on the book. It doesn't need to be spelled out what that help was, but agents and editors all know, you know, what that means.
Right. Does it, whether your name gets on the cover of the book or not, have any correlation to how big of a celebrity the author of the book is? Because I'm trying to remember Andre Agassi's memoir had a pretty big name ghostwriter.
Yes, that's right.
And I don't think his name was on the cover. It's been a long time since I read it, but
yeah, I can't remember. I mean, a book like that, to get that gig, that's just a ton of money, I would guess. And, you know, if you're a sports writer, especially if you follow tennis, that would be an amazing gig to get, although he sounds like he's incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
But in terms of getting your name on it, you know, it really depends on the celebrity. If they don't care about the book as a piece of writing, if they just want their story out there,
right,
then they might be willing to negotiate and have your name on the book. If you're a really, really big ghostwriter, I mean, a lot bigger than me, there's a, you know, maybe it would be a status thing, but I can't imagine a celebrity would even care that much. It's more about what their agent would talk them into or not. And maybe if they cut a deal where they gave you a little less money, but you got your name on the book. I mean, again, every situation is different. Or if it's really important to the ghostwriter, you know, one of the first books I worked on, that Marjorie Margolis Mazvinsky book, my name was on the cover of it. And that was important to me, because I wanted my name on a book. I wasn't deep into ghostwriting yet. And it wasn't in the contract. And I said to Marjorie that I would really love it if she'd consider putting my name on the book, that it would mean a lot for my career. And she was and is somebody who supports women. And she said, yeah, let's do it. And I was, you know, really grateful to her because she didn't need to do that.
Y'all, I just looked up Open by Andre Agassi. J.R. Moringer's name is not on the cover. However, he is co-listed on Goodreads as an author right next to Andre's name.
Interesting.
All right. But let's get into the emotional side a little bit. We've covered some emotional parts. But in your book, you talked a lot about sitting in moral judgment of your subject's past and decisions. What is that like for you? And how do you work through that? Because I've got to imagine it can get sticky sometimes. And we'll talk about another book in your book recommendation segment where it did get sticky for the ghostwriter.
Right. Ghostwriters are just people. And so we have reactions to other people and judge them. I don't know exactly what you're referring to in my book.
I'm trying to remember exactly what it was too. It was a note I took when I was listening.
It's been 5 years since it was published, and there are so many books to read. I'm not rereading mine.
No, certainly not. No.
But here's what I would say about that. It impedes a ghostwriter's ability to write a good book if you get too hung up on moral judgments.
Ah.
You have to see your subject clearly and then think about what would be best for the book, how to present them to their readers. But you also have to negotiate with them what version you're going to show the public. And so if I didn't like one of my subjects, it would make it really hard to go on. And so what I try to do is not gloss over bad qualities, but instead I would try and find something where I could relate to them and to find their humanity, to feel sympathy for them. You know, if they had done something bad, to understand why they had done it, and to have empathy for them, as I would want somebody to have empathy for me. I mean, that being said, I've turned down plenty of gigs, including I got a query from Yasser Arafat's people, so the Palestinian leader.
Yes.
And he was not a good man. And it was an email, and I wrote back, did you look at my last name?
No kidding.
I'm Jewish. Hello?
Right.
I don't know. It's just Yasser Arafat was a bridge too far, for sure.
Sure.
But then, you know, there's other, you know, I ghostwrote for a lot of politicians. And politicians, to get to the level where a lot of these people had gotten to, they had to step over a lot of people and push people out of the way and flip-flop on things and not always, you know, listen to their moral compass. And so I would try to not fixate on that, but see how they were with their children and see how they were with their spouse and, you know, how loving they were, and focus on other things instead of just feeling like I was stuck with this person who was just trying to rewrite history.
Right.
And I would push against rewriting history, which was met with varying degrees of success and failure.
I bet.
But I would also feel if I gave it my best shot and they rejected my approach, then they hired me and that's their prerogative. And if I didn't like it, I was free to end the contract.
So you can get out.
You can. I mean, if it's not working, everybody wants you out. The publisher, the author. I mean, unless you're on an incredible deadline or something. But you usually know early on. And yeah, the whole moral judgment thing, it's you really need to be careful about what you take on, because you don't want to get into a situation where you are trying to get out of a contract. And usually the people I was writing about, there's been so much written about them that you have a good sense of who they are and what they've done and whether or not you can live with that. I mean, I would much rather ghostwrite for somebody whom I admire.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You had mentioned, you know, you and the author have to agree on sort of the version of the author that is going to be presented to the public. Is that done sort of, you spend a lot of time with this person and you're like, hey, I'm thinking about portraying you this way? Or is it like you write the thing and then they look at it?
You write the thing.
Okay.
Because if you describe what you're going to do, you may never start writing, and it's very likely that they're not going to like the sound of it, that it's, you know, it's up to you to artfully present it in a way where they see that it's good for the book.
Yeah. And by nature, you are behind the scenes with ghostwriting.
Yes.
And the author of the book is out promoting the book, taking credit for the book, even though that author didn't write the book. Is that ever tough to swallow for you? And is the compensation enough to sort of calm those thoughts?
Here's what you want as a ghostwriter. You want to be paid well. You want to write something that you're proud of. You want to write something that the publisher and the celebrity like. That's enough. You know, again, it's not ghostwriting. It's a transaction. It's a practical endeavor. And you know, there can be sections of it that you're really proud of, but it would be inappropriate for them to be out on the circuit talking about their ghostwriter, usually, unless, again, it's somebody who just has no pride of authorship and is just excited to get their story out there.
Right. Jessica Simpson was very open, I feel like, about thanking her ghostwriter just all over the place in the media.
Yeah, I mean, there have been people who have done that, certainly. I think I remember that a long time ago, Whoopi Goldberg, maybe even in her acknowledgments, wrote very lovingly about her ghostwriter. But that's unusual. Celebrities often, I'm going to make a sweeping generalization, they have a big ego, and so they want everything to be about them. For me, I really just wanted to be, again, thanked in the acknowledgments so that it would help me with finding my next gig. And you want it to get a good review. If the review says something about how authentic it sounds or doesn't even mention sort of the writing, but just is praising the overall story, then you've done your job and you feel good about it. And many ghostwriters ghostwrite because it helps pay the mortgage. And they've got other kinds of writing that they do. They write their own books or they do journalism.
Right.
So they don't need this for their ego. They need this for their livelihood.
Sure.
But then there are some ghostwriters who only ghostwrite. And, you know, I think maybe for ghostwriters who only ghostwrite, then to get your name on the cover might be more important to you. And it'd be nice if they, at least at book events or something, would mention you in some way. And they don't have to say that you ghostwrote it, but just that you know, there's so many different ways. Helped prepare the manuscript. I mean, that is one of the things with acknowledgments. I find that the more menial the task you're thanked for, the more you actually did. So
interesting.
I joked for many years that if I'm thanked for my good cheer, it means that I wrote the whole book.
That's fascinating. So now I'm going to read acknowledgments with a very keen eye. So speaking of ghostwriters having their own writing they're working on, can you share with us anything about what you're currently working on right now?
Yes. So I'm working on, and working on in air quotes. I've written a manuscript. It's a mystery. Before we moved to Berkeley, the first year we lived in California, we lived in Marin, which is she, gorgeous county adjacent to San Francisco. And the apartment building, we lived in the apartment complex. There was just a lot going on there. The people there were wacky and the police kept getting called for really strange things. One day I was sitting out at the pool with a couple of the other residents. The police showed up again in the middle of the day. And one of the women looked at me and said, gosh, everything happens here. And I said, yeah, just about everything except for murder. And that it was a light bulb moment. I was like, oh my God, a murder. This is the perfect setting for a murder.
Yes. It sounds very Big Little Lies.
It was total Big Little Lies. And so it's this group of five women who live in this apartment complex and a series of murders happens. So I've written the whole thing and I have an agent, but she does mostly nonfiction. So I'm looking for an agent to handle this. And I sent it out to a really big agent, someone who does mysteries. And he said, you know, the writing, the characters, it's all great, but it's not suspenseful enough. And that's a pretty big problem. So I'm trying to figure out how to fix that. Then in the meantime, my other project is this really odd obsession I've got. When I was in my late 20s, I was driving back from the Berkshires in Massachusetts and my friend's car broke down. I wandered into an antique store and ended up buying for $1 a diary of a 15-year-old girl from that town in Lee, Massachusetts from 1872. That was in my late 20s and I'm 62 now, so you can do the math. And I got an idea to write it as a nonfiction, like a memoir, and use it as sort of a vehicle for writing a memoir about writing. But in the meantime, in these 30 plus years since I bought the diary, everything's gone online. And so I've been able to trace her family.
Oh, interesting.
So that's what I'm doing.
That's exciting.
Thank you.
All right, let's get to your book recommendations.
Okay, great.
And y'all, as usual, Barbara is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she did not love, kind of, this is going to get more complicated, and one upcoming release she is excited about. So tell me about the first old book you loved.
Okay, so the first old book I loved is called Henry and Clara, and it was published in 1994, and it's written by Thomas Mallon, who's this wonderful author and journalist and retired professor who has made a name for himself writing Washington-oriented historical novels. So what Thomas Mallon does is he often takes somebody who's real and focuses on people near the famous person. What I love about it is the exploration of the proximity to power. So Henry of the title is Henry Rathbone, and Clara is Clara Harris. And they were the couple in the box at Ford's Theater with President Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln the night that President Lincoln was assassinated. They were real people. Henry and Clara were stepbrother and stepsister.
I saw that. That was interesting. Also engaged, right?
Well, and then they married. Yeah, okay. At the time they were engaged. Yeah. And so that was like something that they were got some heat for. But this, on top of a Civil War trauma, pushes him into this descent into madness, which goes on for decades. And that's what the book, they get married, they have children, and we follow him into madness. So it's got a lot of my favorite things in it. Washington before, during, and after the Civil War. I'm really interested in the city of Washington at that time. It's got madness, it's got obsession, but most important to me is what proximity to power does to an ordinary-ish, in this case, person. And it's just one of my favorite books. I just love it. If you like historical novels that are different, this is for you.
And I like the side stories.
Yeah, the side stories are great.
That's Henry and Clara by Thomas Mallon. And tell us about the second old book you loved.
Okay, so the second old book is not that old. It's from 2017.
Old enough.
Old enough. And it's called Bleecker House, not to be confused with Bleak House, Charles Dickens, but Bleecker House by Nell Stephens, who's a young British writer. And this is a memoir about the process of writing. And she is a quirky writer, and she does really interesting things with how she structures. She's got now another book, and I think she's got a novel that's going to come out. But this book and her next book are structured in a really interesting way. And I've tried to look for some kind of a model for my diary project and come up kind of cold, except for Bleecker House. So what she does is, so let me tell you a little bit about her. She's at the time of this memoir, a 27-year-old newly graduated writer from an MFA program. And she gets a 6-week paid in fellowship. She gets to go anywhere in the world to try and finish working on her current project, which is her first novel. And she's got 10,000 words written. And she read on the internet somewhere, I'm sort of quoting her, she read on the internet that a first novel should be 90,000 words, which is actually a good length for a book. So instead of choosing like Paris or Florence or, I don't know, St. Bart's, she chooses something called Bleecker Island, which is an 8 square mile, you know, just this little island in the southeast of the Falkland Islands. And it's like muddy and rocky, and there's literally nothing there. But she decided if she chose something like that, there'd be nothing to do except for actually write her book, because she wouldn't even have an internet connection. So the structure of it is she'll do a chapter about what's going on with her trying to write during these 6 weeks. And then she'll have a chapter that's actually part of the novel that she's trying to write, and then also some short stories. So it's her fiction. It switches back and forth. And she admits right up front that her fiction isn't working. And she talks about why. It flips back and forth. It's just a really weird idea and a weird book. And it reminded me of, you know, being young and trying to get your sea legs for writing. And it's really at its heart, it's a book about figuring out what you want to write and how you're going to do it. And it's really funny and lovely. It's not for everybody, but if it's for you, it's really for you.
And 5 years later, she does have her debut novel coming out.
Oh, that's so great.
It's coming out in July, and it's called Briefly, A Delicious Life. And I wonder if any parts of it were, you know, nuggets were from the original debut.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
All right. That was Bleaker House by Nell Stevens. And tell me about the first new book you loved.
Okay. The first new book I loved is called The Latinist. And that came out just in January, 2 months ago. And it's by Mark Prins, P-R-I-N-S. And it's a psychological thriller, which is, you know, my favorite genre. And it's set in academia. And since I spent 25 years working at Georgetown as a professor, I could really relate to it. Although as a professor of journalism, I wasn't in the whole academic, like there was no tenure available for me. I didn't have to do papers. It was just more professor of the practice. But I was surrounded by it, and I'm actually married to it. My husband's a retired English professor. We met at Georgetown. So I had a front row seat to the silliness of academia, the cutthroat silliness. So I love novels that are set in academia or in newsrooms. And this is sort of in the tradition of The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which I loved, and Possession by A.S. Byatt. I'm only going to give away what happens like in the first couple of pages and probably on the book flap.
Perfect.
It's about a classics professor named Chris. It's set at Oxford. And he has become obsessed with one of his graduate students, one of his PhD students. Her name is Tessa Templeton. And she's about to finish her PhD, and she started applying for teaching positions, and he doesn't want her to leave him in Oxford. So this is what's given away in the first few pages. He sabotages her job prospects he's her mentor. And so as it always is, it's up to him to write the main letter that goes out, recommendation letter. And he's written her one that's sort of damning and faint praise. And she can't figure out what's going on. And then she figures out what's going on. It's a bit dense because it goes into the classics, which is not something that I know about, but I really actually enjoyed it.
I felt like Secret History was a little bit the same way.
Yes. When you read it, you need to be focused on it.
Right. That's good to know, though.
Yeah.
Especially for something that's labeled as a psychological thriller.
Yes. It's got a lot of twists and turns, and it's really fun, and it's really well written, and he really knows academia.
I've never heard of this book, and it sounds totally up my alley. I love a campus novel, and I love a dark, sort of messed up campus novel in particular.
Yes. Yeah. It's very dark.
That's The Latinist by Mark Prins. And tell me about the second new book you love.
So this book, I cheated a little bit. It was published in England in 2020, but it was published in the U.S. in October 2021.
That's not cheating. That's fair. I go by U.S. publication dates here.
Okay. So Small Pleasures by Claire Chambers. It's a really quirky, fun, odd little book. It's set in London, in the London suburbs in 1957. And it's this woman named Jean Swinney, who's hurtling towards 40, and she's very lonely, and she works in a newsroom doing sort of the women's page kind of stuff, and not taken terribly seriously by all her male colleagues. I mean, they're fine, but her life is pretty drab. And she takes care of her aging mother, who's very overbearing and no fun at all. And one day, the newspaper receives a letter from a local woman who claims that her daughter, who's like, I can't remember, 8 or 9 years old, is the result of a virgin birth and that she would like it investigated. So apparently, around that time, this is now I'm talking about in real life, there was this interest in science. Scientists were looking into whether or not this could actually happen. And the author, Claire Chambers, was listening to a radio interview about this alleged phenomenon.
Oh, interesting.
And it gave her the idea for the novel. And it's just this weird mystery that turns into this sad love story. And it's charming and just odd. And it takes you away from the pandemic. It's just in another time, in another place. You won't read anything else like it.
I have to ask you about the ending, because when I was researching this book, I saw on Goodreads many divisive opinions about the ending. Without spoiling what the ending was, what did you think about the ending? Were you for it or against it?
You know, I liked the ending. Okay. I was for it. Yeah, I felt the whole thing worked.
All right. That was Small Pleasures by Claire Chambers. And let's talk about the book you did not like and kind of explain sort of the context of why you're sharing it today.
Right. So like many of your interviewees who have come before me, it's hard as a writer to pick out a book that you're going to trash. So I'm going to trash this book, and I haven't read it. I'm going to trash the idea of its very existence. And that is Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal, which was ghostwritten by Tony Schwartz. So this is not a book I didn't like because I didn't read it. It's a book that I wish had never been written. And the reason why I wish it had never been written is because it helped propel Trump upward and in front of everybody. It really made him more famous, more prominent. And I think it just should never have been written. The ghostwriter, Tony Schwartz, is in total agreement with me on that. I mean, I don't know, but just if you Google him.
Right. And y'all, I'll link to a New Yorker article about this situation. It is fascinating.
It is fascinating. So Tony Schwartz was a reporter. I forgot where. He knew Trump. And when Trump wanted to do this book, he got Tony Schwartz to do it. And he got paid a lot of money up front, I'm sure. I don't know how much. I can't remember.
He got half of the book's $500,000 advance.
That's a lot of money.
And he got half of the royalties. Is that normal?
No.
Okay.
I got royalties for something that I helped research, a very, very, very small amount. But it's very unusual in my experience or the experience of people I know. I don't know anybody who's gotten royalties. And so that was, you know, a brilliant deal he cut.
Right. And he got his name on the cover.
He got his name on the cover. And he wishes that he hadn't written the book. He feels terrible about it. His politics are diametrically opposed to Trump's, and he feels in part responsible for Trump and, you know, the whole thing. And the reason why I chose this book is because I think it's a really good way to talk about the ethics of ghostwriting. You know, you asked me about if I sit in moral judgment for whom I write. It's more than that. I sit in moral judgment of myself. I've wrestled with that because while you have no power as a ghostwriter, you have power in that you are helping to promote somebody. And I think if I had it to do over again, well, I might not become a ghostwriter at all.
Oh, that's a whole nother topic to get into. We're going to do that on the bonus episode for patrons, y'all.
Oh boy, that's where I really let it hang out, I guess. So, you know, the ethics of ghostwriting, especially as somebody who taught journalism, the ethics of journalism and the ethics of ghostwriting are very different. It's hard to sustain both. And I did it mainly because it was a source of income. And I mean, usually I was writing for people whose politics I thought were just fine. But would the world be a slightly better place if some of those books hadn't been written? I don't know. I mean, somebody else would have done it, but, you know, did I need to be involved in it? I don't know. But I think this example of Tony Schwartz and The Art of the Deal is a really important one. And I think it's something that ghostwriters should think about, like how, no pun intended, these books that you work on come back to haunt you.
Sure. And when I read the New Yorker article, in addition to the politics part, he talked a lot about character traits that he was fully aware of and saw repeatedly throughout the ghostwriting process that would sort of make it a little dicey for that person to be president.
Right.
The other thing I was wondering, as I'm reading this article and a couple others, Can he get sued for talking out like this after the fact? Is there some sort of confidentiality agreement that he's broken at this point?
Yeah. So he's probably talked about that. And so I don't know the answer. Usually celebrities aren't going to go and sue you unless they get really pissed off.
Yeah. I think Trump did threaten to sue him, but also I don't know if there's truth behind that he can or not.
Yeah. And Trump threatens to sue everybody, and he often sues people and it goes nowhere, but it wouldn't be a fun thing to worry about. So I don't know if he signed something. Yeah. Because he's breaking a confidentiality agreement if he signed one. But again, Trump would in general have bigger fish to fry than his ghostwriter. But yeah, that would be a concern. But I think Tony Schwartz, that this is his way of sort of making amends.
Right. And do you ever have a ghostwriting assignment where there is not a confidentiality agreement?
No, there's always one.
Okay. All right. That was The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump / Tony Schwartz. Tell me about the upcoming release that you're looking forward to. And I think many people are looking forward to this one.
Oh, I'm really excited about this. So this is Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel, who wrote, among other things, The Glass Hotel and Station 11, both of which I loved. And the reason I chose this book is because I love that she gets me out of my comfort zone. I'm not a sci-fi person. I'm not into dystopian stories. It's like totally out of my comfort level and what I usually choose. And this, I mean, it just sounds incredible. There is, you know, the description of it is this 18-year-old guy is exiled from society after he had some sort of diatribe at a dinner party. And he goes into the forest and he becomes spellbound by the beauty of the Canadian wilderness. And he hears a violin in an airship terminal. I mean, that makes me think of Station 11.
Right.
And then this flips around time-wise. 2 centuries later, I'm just reading the promotional stuff, a famous writer is on a book tour, so I love that. There's like something familiar.
Right.
She actually lives on the moon, but she's doing her book tour all over Earth. And it just sounds like so much fun. I just trust her. I trust her because if I'd read the promotional material for either The Glass Hotel or Station 11, I might not have read either one of them.
This is hilarious because that is exactly what I have in my notes.
Really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and I felt the same way about The Glass Hotel. I read the premise of the book, and I'm like, this sounds insane and all over the place, and I don't know about this. But she can pull it off. It's the craziest thing.
It is. Yeah, and The Glass Hotel I read because somebody whose taste I really trust said, you have to read this. So I was like, okay. And, you know, during the pandemic, it's still going on, but during sort of the height of it, the most isolating part of it, my husband and I were just reading, you know, like a book a day. It was crazy how much we were reading just to escape reality. Yeah, I read that book and I was just like blown away.
I'll be interested to see how it pans out for sure.
Me too.
I loved Station 11. I liked parts of The Glass Hotel more than other parts, but I'll be interested to see how this pans out.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
That's Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel, and that's coming out April 5th, so very soon. And I like to close out every episode with asking each guest, what was the last 5-star book you read?
So I chose Apples Never Fall by Leanne Moriarty. I chose that because I'm trying to read several of her books just as inspiration models for my struggling murder mystery that I'm working on. And I just think she's so good at portraying, you know, little networks of people, whether they're families or a group of friends. And I love this book. You know, it's just one of those books where the past, it just illustrates the past is always with us. And it's both a mystery, a real page turner. And so it's this great mystery. And it's set among this dysfunctional family that has been sort of torn apart a bit. Frayed, at least, by competition, the competition of tennis and
And that was Apples Never Fall by Leanne Moriarty. Thank you so much, Barbara. This has been so fascinating. I loved hearing behind the scenes of ghostwriting.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. It was really fun to talk about everything.
And y'all, the March Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Barbara's picks for categories like favorite and least favorite parts of being a ghostwriter and a telltale sign a book has been ghostwritten. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show on Patreon, and there's a link in my show notes and in my Instagram bio. And next week, March 30th, Catherine and I will be back for the Winter Circle Back episode. Talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at sarahsshelves, on Instagram at sarahsbookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.